We are going to be taking public testimony this morning in support or in opposition to Governor Dayton's proposal, his budget proposal for 2012-13. We have a number of testifiers. There's obviously a lot of folks with strong opinions about this budget. So we are going to begin with, let me just set the framework for what's going to happen today. We have so many that we're going to ask all speakers to limit their remarks to 3 minutes. We're going to keep time. We're going to tell you when time is up. So please be aware of that. And if what you have to say is what someone else has already said, please will you just let us know that. We would appreciate that in the interest of time and making sure everybody with an opinion gets heard. We are going to take groups of three at a time. And we'll ask you to testify, and then at the end we'll save time for questions. So those that are interested, I hope you can stay till the end, because that's when we're going to take questions, unless we're seeking a very important point of clarity from your presentation. So with that, let me just tell you the order here. We are going to first hear from AFSCME, AFL-CIO, and the police and fire. So that's John Thorson, Jennifer Schaubach, and Brian Rice, if you all would come to the table at the same time. And then behind them, we will have Patricia Nauman, Keith Carlson, and Steve Peterson. And we may ask Gary, well, I guess there's going to be a second group of folks from the cities, counties, and townships. So the second group up will be Keith Carlson, Patricia Nauman, and Steve Peterson. After that, we're going to have Gary Carlson and Kent Sulem, I think it is, from the townships. So Mr. Thorson, Ms. Schaubach, and Mr. Rice, if you could join us at the table, please.
I haven't seen Brian or John as
I
of yet,
think so. Mr. Rice was just here. Why don't we ask then, if they aren't here, Mr. Thorson or Mr. Rice, then let's have Mr. Carlson and Jeff Spartz prepared following Ms. Schaubach's testimony.
Great. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I am the legislative director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO, which is a labor federation made up of more than 1,000 affiliated unions representing more than 300,000 working men and women around the state. We applaud Governor Dayton's budget, which makes long overdue investments in students and communities while asking those who have been the most fortunate to do their part in building a better future for Minnesotans. The governor has presented a balanced path forward to save and create jobs while protecting middle-class families. I've heard a lot about business, but very little about the hardworking Minnesotans that make those businesses successful. They paid for it with their jobs, their homes, their lives. Too many Minnesotans are still unemployed or underemployed and struggling to put food on the table and keep their homes. More tax breaks for businesses while cutting necessary funding to education, healthcare, and public services would only cause more devastation to families who have paid the most in this recession and is definitely not the answer. Many families who suffered a job loss during the recession find themselves in a more dire situation today than they were a year or two ago. Extended unemployment benefits are expiring, meaning that millions of long-term unemployed workers could lose their unemployment benefits. Although the job market has seen little improvement since the recession ended, workers who cannot find jobs are now seeing their public services being sacrificed for more tax breaks to the wealthy and businesses. Today, even though the National Bureau of Economic Recovery says the recession has been officially over for 20 months, economic distress and joblessness remain widespread. Employers reported 33,800 openings in Minnesota in the fourth quarter of 2010. With 206,000 unemployed people, the latest data from the Department of Employment and Economic Development shows there are nearly 6 unemployed people per job opening. Jobs Now Coalition noted that only 20,000 of the jobs are full-time, meaning job seekers outnumber full-time jobs 10 to 1. I've heard that this budget will chase higher-income households and businesses out of Minnesota. I would respectfully disagree. Many businesses regularly uproot to follow economic opportunity. However, quality of life is an equally important factor in their decision to stay or go, as well as good schools, clean air and water, and low crime. All of these public services, and all of these have been neglected over the last 8 years. I'm a believer that business and labor have a symbiotic relationship. However, as businesses continue to profit and get tax break after tax break, their workers are being left behind. Productivity is up, but pay, benefits, and rights for workers are being attacked. Putting Minnesotans back to work and rebuilding our communities should be our number one priority. If we attempt to continue with the failed policies of the past and undermine workers and their families while not addressing our serious revenue problems fairly, we will not come out of this recession as a leader among states as we once were. A cuts-only budget would only increase the burden on working families by sacrificing many of our nurses, firefighters, and teachers who provide priceless public services to our state, all the while neglecting investments in job creation that are not only essential to reducing unemployment, but are ultimately the key to widely sharing prosperity and economic health. The Minnesota AFL-CIO stands with Governor Dayton in his bold initiative to finally address our revenue crisis fairly, and we hope you will too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Schaubach. Mr. Rice, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Brian Rice. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis with the law firm of Rice, Michaels, and Walther. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, the Police Alliance of Minnesota, the Police Federation of Minneapolis, and the Minneapolis Police and Fire Relief Associations. I want to touch on two points. One, our organization support Governor Dayton's proposal on local government aid. And I want to call a special attention to page 64 of the governor's budget dealing with police and fire state aids. One quick point. I've worked in the pension field for almost 30 years now. For the first time ever on June 30th of last year, the number of members of the police and fire, PRA Police and Fire Fund actually went down. That is the tipping point. First time ever, fewer members because cities are starting to lay off police and firefighters. And that was on June 30th of last year. Knowing what's happened over the last couple years and the very difficult task you're facing before you now, there's no doubt those numbers are going to decline. But I think that's a very much a leading indicator. So we do support the governor's local government aid program, but we obviously know you've got many difficult tasks ahead of you, and anything we can do to preserve those very important jobs are critical. Minnesota's 47th in fire protection on what they spend, and it's about 22nd on public safety, but that's a trend that's increased in recent years in the last decade, because I think there has been a strong commitment to public safety on behalf of this legislature on a bipartisan basis. Let me close quickly just on page 64, local aids and credits. Normally, in economic times, this matter doesn't get much attention, but Minnesota has a unique way of funding its public safety pensions, and that's basically the gross earnings premiums tax on auto policies for police and homeowner coverage for fire are dedicated to pay the pension costs of police and fire. So virtually every firefighter in the state, volunteer full-time, receives an allocation from that formula, and every police officer, whether it's a city officer, a county sheriff, a state patrol officer, a game warden, a tribal officer, a University of Minnesota police officer, has their pensions paid through this program. In fact, the Fire State Aid program was probably the first state tax in 1873 dedicated to local government aid, and the same happens with the auto insurance tax that supports and undergirds the pension system for that. And I know in these very difficult times you're going to be examining every part of the budget, but and my main point on that is this. Police officers and firefighters are not, I'll repeat, not covered by Social Security. The only pension that they get is from this legislature for their service. So ensuring the integrity of those plans is really of the utmost concern to members in the law enforcement community. These programs have worked well. We've worked with the insurance industry. And it's really, I would consider it a sacred commitment on part of the state to these men and women in public safety that put their lives on the line. That one time Dwayne Benson, who was considered one of the smartest guys in the state, talked about taking a pension contribution holiday when the markets were down. It's really the worst time to do that. I mean, when the market is bad and there's blood in the streets, that's when you want to invest in these things. So we hope you keep that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Are you Mr. Thorson?
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Senator Howe, we're going to try and take questions at the end unless you need an immediate clarification to understand his comments.
I do have just a clarification on that. When you talk about that percentage, does the fee, I believe the DPS also allocates out of that fee for officers and firefighters that are killed in the line of duty, that fee also pays for the health insurance or medical benefits or medical insurance for the spouses or dependent children?
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chairman, Senator Howe, the program you're talking about is in the Department of Public Safety. That's actually a general fund program that the legislature passed subsequent to these aid programs to deal with killed in the line of duty benefits or health insurance benefits to disabled police officers or firefighters. And I think that's just a separate general fund appropriation. These streams of revenue are kind of dedicated, in a sense, from those insurance programs.
Thank you. Thanks for that clarification.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Mr. Thorson, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Thorson with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, Council 5. We represent 43,000 women and men who provide public services in the state of Minnesota. In addition to supporting the revenue raisers in this bill and the way that the revenue is raised in protecting the middle class and keeping property taxes down, we believe very strongly that this is a bill that is a jobs bill. It preserves jobs in the state of Minnesota, preserves jobs for the women and men who deliver services in counties, cities, and schools throughout the state. It preserves jobs in the nonprofit sector with counties contracting for that work. And it also preserves jobs when it allows counties and cities and schools to continue their capital projects and make planning, which is something that has been suspended and curtailed with the recent cuts to aids and credits. And as a job in the hand is quite frankly worth two in the bush right now. As right now, Minnesota job seekers outnumber full-time job openings at a rate of 10 to 1. The latest deed figures on the Minnesota job vacancy survey says that in Minnesota there are 200,006 unemployed workers competing for 33,800 unfilled jobs. And of those openings, only 20,600 are full-time. So that's 10 job seekers for every job available right now. And again, this is a bill that keeps Minnesotans working, and for that, we strongly support it.
Thank you, Mr. Thorson. We next have Mr. Keith Carlson, Jeff Spartz, and Patricia Nauman.
Madam Chair, I have a hand up, please. Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 13 of the 16 larger counties in the state of Minnesota. Our member counties support the general tenor of the governor's budget. Has a level of government that suffered $120 million worth of cuts in our county program aid and market value credit reimbursement, and a $34 million reduction in our certified program aid for the current year. We're obviously grateful for the lack of cuts in these programs within this budget. However, we're not naive enough to believe that when this session concludes that those programs will go untouched. That being the case, we think it's important to point out the full array of the budget changes affecting counties in this budget. We're the one level of local government that is, in fact, cut in the governor's budget. The handout that I've distributed itemizes the budget changes exclusively and directly affecting counties. There are over $74 million worth of reductions in counties on the in the governor's budget before offsetting for the continuation of funding for the statewide health improvement program. Nearly all these cuts are in programs or for services over which we have no control. We have no choice but to deliver them under current state and federal law. Because they're generally mandated. Consequently, we have to make reductions in other services to fill in for these cuts. I'm going to just quickly go through the cuts and tell you what they are, what the acronyms stand for. CCSA is the Children and Community Services Block Grant. Counties use these almost exclusively to provide child protection services. When we receive a report of abuse or neglect, we must respond, and if it's necessary to protect the victims of these this abuse and neglect, we have to pay for expensive out-of-home placement of those individuals. The change in the MFIP consolidated fund pays in part for our cost of administration of MFIP, again, a program over which we have no choice. We have to administer it. We do have some choice on the other part of the program, which is to provide what is called emergency assistance to individuals on MFIP who are facing the loss of their housing or other emergencies such as utility shutoff. But if we reduce those grants, it's at a long-term cost of lack of stability in that household, and it defeats our efforts to break the cycle of poverty in those households. EGA and EMSA is somewhat similar to emergency assistance. Again, we can cut it, but at a long-term cost of lack of stability for frequently individuals who are mentally ill or chemically dependent. Child support incentive grants are monies that we receive to perform what we must do under current state law and under the state's obligation to the federal government to enforce child support orders for everybody on public assistance and for those individuals not on public assistance who request our assistance in enforcing or getting those monies.
Mr. Carlson?
Sure.
I'm sorry, we kind of set the ground rules at 3 minutes per person.
Sure.
And I want to hear the rest of your testimony. I believe the committee would too. Can we ask you to complete this portion, the rest of your testimony when we've taken all the others?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Because I think we would like to talk about this, and I'd like to hear the explanation of each of these, but we can't take that time right now based on the rules for everybody. So if you wouldn't mind staying and maybe taking this up at the end.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Spartz.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Spartz. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. That is an organization that has all 87 counties in the state as members. Before I say anything about the proposed governor's budget, I would like to make a few remarks about perceptions the leadership of my organization has about state government in general. They perceive that we have run into chronic structural problems, that we are going to have a difficult time, no matter what the economy is like, financing state government going forward. They have been talking about, and we are starting to engage in some ideas on how to redesign local service delivery to better control costs and provide outcomes for the communities that we serve. One of the issues I think we're going to have to look at is the amount of money being spent on process management. A very wise professor of economics told me when I was an undergraduate student of that dismal science that you never spend more than a dollar to get a dollar's worth of result. And I think we have let ourselves get in a position where we have worried more about the processes than about the results we're trying to get for the citizens that we serve. So we would certainly like to work with the legislature going forward on some concepts about redesigning local government so that we can deliver the services citizens need, we can deliver them effectively and as efficiently as humanly possible. Having said that, I'll have a couple of brief remarks about the governor's budget. Basically, with the local aids being held intact, and only a fairly modest hit, $79 million for human service, we're not going to get up in arms about the governor's budget. I mean, we like that idea. However, we also recognize that the leadership will have its own version of a budget put forward fairly soon, and who knows where we're going to end up, somewhere in between or possibly a number that nobody's contemplated to date. Having said that, we understand there are going to be reductions in order at the local level. We'll accept those as gracefully as we can, but what we ask in return is the legislature give us autonomy at the local level so that our elected officials can make intelligent decisions for the services that they see as priorities in their community and deliver those services. One of the concepts we're going to throw out there is the idea of going from the restrictive Dillon rule, which greatly limits what local governments can do, to home rule, which counties in 10 states in this country have. And with home rule, you do for the good and welfare as long as the legislature has not prohibited you from doing so. So, and the last remark I want to make is the governor has proposed property taxes at the state level for high-value homes. As a local unit, or local units, we always get nervous when others start to look at our major source of revenue. So thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Spartz. Ms. Nauman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, and we represent cities in the 7-county metro area at the legislature. We want to thank the governor this morning for not further reducing aids and credits in his budget proposal. This is consistent with our position of opposing further reductions, and we really see it as a respite from the past several years and state budget cycles when cities have seen their aids and credits reduced significantly, and we would argue disproportionately to other areas of the state budget. We're at the point now where many cities in the metropolitan area actually no longer receive any LGA, and many cities in the metro area have also seen their LGA levels remain very flat. So we do believe that the governor's proposal recognizes the hits that cities have already taken in the past several years, and we appreciate that. We do think that cities have shared a great deal in the sacrifices that we've all had to make with regard to the economy. They've cut positions. They've cut services. In Minneapolis alone, there have been over 400 positions cut since 2008. I also want to add that we believe that LGA plays a very key role in the health of the region, which is really the economic driver of our state. It allows cities to be able to provide the basic and important infrastructure that both businesses and residents rely on. It also functions as a form of property tax relief for business and residential property taxpayers. And we think that this really does help the region to remain economically competitive and create a high quality of life for citizens and businesses. In addition, LGA also, in addition to being able to allow cities to provide the basic services, I just want to point out that cities have a lot of demands on their budget that go beyond these basic services and basic infrastructure. They're dealing with lots of issues that have been a function of the economic recession, like foreclosures, for example, and having to address issues like neighborhood stabilization. I do want to also point out that we are do have concerns about the statewide property tax in the governor's budget that is, as Mr. Spartz pointed out, a key revenue source for cities, and cities do not have very diverse revenue sources, so we would be concerned that about the property tax provision of the governor's budget. We look forward to working with you as you craft your own budget, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. Next, we'll hear from Peterson, Steve Peterson, Gary Carlson, and Kent Sulem. Mr. Peterson from the Coalition, Mr. Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities, and Mr. Sulem from Minnesota Townships. Mr. Peterson, would you like to begin?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Peterson. I am here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. For years, there has been, since 2002, which was the last time we went through a major restructuring of the property tax system in the 2001 session, there have been reductions in state aids and credits, not every year, but overall. Since 2002, in a per capita inflation-adjusted dollars, aids and credits going to cities have dipped 54%. This has created pressure, not surprisingly, on local property taxes. And the cities that received LGA, or that were certified to receive LGA in 2010, their property taxes since 2002 in real adjusted dollars have gone up 26%. This is at the same time that the revenue they have for spending, like for the services that keep our communities strong, have actually decreased 13%. So we've seen property taxes go up and revenues go down. That is why we are here to support the aids and credits portion of the governor's budget, because he does not put further pressure on the property tax by reducing state aids or credits. We believe that the governor's budget helps protect the taxpayers in greater Minnesota and helps keep those local communities strong and remain to provide the critical services they need, like police, fire, libraries, streets, snow plowing, et cetera. We believe that in the end, of course, it's going to be a compromise between the legislature and the governor, and we hope that we can say the same at the end, that when the final deal is struck, that Minnesota's communities, especially in greater Minnesota, remain strong and vibrant under the final deal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. Let me start by saying that we haven't seen a copy of the actual legislation that will embody the governor's budget, state aids and credits and taxes, and I would like to reserve the right, as we see the actual bill, to maybe make further comment at another date. With that, the League of Cities supports a strong state-local partnership. We have had a partnership with the state, not only a fiscal partnership with the state over the years, but a partnership in providing services to citizens throughout the state of Minnesota. To that end, we have a strong policy that has been in place a long time that supports finding state budget stability, trying to make sure that the relationship we have with the state is a stable partnership that is predictable for our cities to develop their budgets and provide the services that citizens demand. To that end, we do support having the legislators look at at all available options to try to balance your budget. And our policy goes on to say specifically, including looking at revenue increases. We do not have a policy specific to the tax increases proposed by the governor in his budget. Let me just be clear on that. But we do have two policies that are fairly consistent with provisions in the governor's budget, one being the affiliate nexus provisions that are in the governor's recommendations. Our cities have seen a challenge to their Main Street businesses, and we've been looking at the nationwide streamlined sales tax as a way to try to level the playing field for our Main Street businesses to make sure that they're viable and competitive. And the affiliate nexus provisions, we feel, will move in the right direction to make sure those Main Street businesses are on more of an even keel with internet sale providers or internet retailers. Secondly, we do support, in general concept, the sales tax to online lodging reservations. About 120 cities have local lodging taxes across the state, plus another 10 or so cities that have specific legislative authorization for lodging taxes. We feel that those online lodging tax provisions will help with those communities' revenue streams. On the expenditure side, very briefly, Madam Chair, we support the governor's provisions on not further cutting state aids. Let me clarify what Mr. Keith Carlson said. Last year, one of the few areas of the budget that was cut by the 2010 legislature for the upcoming biennium were state aids and credits to cities and counties. Cities lost $56 million a year in last year's supplemental budget, $31 million from LGA, $26 million from market value homestead credit reimbursements. That was your first down payment on this $6.2 billion deficit that was built in last year in the supplemental budget, Chapter 215. So we think we have given already in terms of budget cuts. That said, we understand the magnitude of the remaining deficit, and we're willing to work with you to solve that deficit. Thank you, Madam
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kent Sulem, General Counsel for the Minnesota Association of Townships. Like my city and county colleagues, I too am here to support the governor's provisions that there not be further cuts in local government aid and credits. Unlike my colleagues, however, I can honestly say part of our concern is we've already given 100%. 100% of our LGA is gone. 100% of our HACA credits are gone. Other than the gas tax, which is a constitutional issue, our sources of revenue from the state are now limited to market value credit and PILT payments, neither one of which were reduced in the governor's recommendations, and thankfully neither one of which for our level were reduced in Chapter 1 that the House and Senate sent to the governor. And we do appreciate that. A couple of quick concerns that we have regarding the PILT and market value credit programs. Even though they weren't being proposed to be reduced, with PILT, with more lands coming off the tax rolls in the future, upcoming years with the legacy funds, if there's not a source of replacement funding, even though it's held even, there will be a practical reduction because we'll be spreading that same size pie, that same PILT pie will be spread over a much larger area, meaning an actual reduction for individual communities. With the market value credit, one of the perverse effects of the budget bill last year is that with the cut being made permanent, we are seeing a budget shortfall every year unless we over-levy, because the counties are required to back off the market value credit. The state has already put into statute that they will not honor 100% of their commitment. And so we're left with a shortfall unless we over-levy. So if we need $100,000, we're advising our folks that they have to levy $105,000, $110,000. So when the market value credit is backed off and the state withholds the percentage they're not going to pay, we actually collect what we need. And so I would encourage this committee, to working with your wonderful staff, to revisit that formula so that at least the levy we set is the levy we're getting. The last thing I'll leave you with is the impact that the townships have seen since the LGA was eliminated and phased out starting in the year 2000. And I'll cite to a wonderful report that the state auditor just released about a month ago, which is a review of our 2009 expenditures and revenues. But it contains a decennial review. And what it concludes is that in the year 2000, we were 50.9% property tax dependent at the township level, 49.1% other sources of revenue, and that would include aides, fees, interest, et cetera. By 2009, after the aides had been completely reduced and the market value credit reductions had started to kick in, we were now 70.4% property tax dependent, which shows that there is a major, major shift to the property tax at a time where in the rural areas people may have land value, but they don't have the incomes that are keeping up with the land values. So I'll leave you with that.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan. Madam Chair. Just 1 second, Senator Rest. Mr. Dave Keller, if you're still here, will take your testimony next, and then Brian Resch from the Joint Religious Legislative Council or Coalition, and Nan Madden from the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. Senator Rest, do you have a specific question for one of these testifiers?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. Senator Rest.
For any of you, but I guess specifically right now for Mr. Carlson. What would you think of a trade-off of abolishing or repealing the market value credit, repealing the sales tax imposed on local governments, and taking some LGA cuts?
Mr. Carlson.
Would that be a good would that be a good trade-off, or in particular for the future, if the spigot was turned off on those first two items, and then if they're, you know, looking for something that wasn't just a giveaway, but that there might need to be some adjustment in LGA? And the reason why I say that is everybody gets market value credit. Everybody has to pay this. All forms of government have to pay the sales tax. Only some cities get LGA, and the same thing. I mean, all counties, I guess, get some county aid. But would that be a good trade-off in theory, or is that would that do more harm than good?
Senator Rust, we have a pretty tight timeline for today. We had told all testifiers they would have 3 minutes so that we could get all the way through the agenda, and we've asked to take big topics for conversation to the end of the hearing. As a courtesy to the other testifiers, can we ask Mr. Carlson to maybe comment at the end of our hearing? It may give him some time to think through what you just said. All right, then. Thank you, gentlemen. As I said before, if Mr. Dave Keller was able to stay, hopefully you can join us at the table now, Mr. Brian Resch and Nan Madden from the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. I'm guessing you're Mr. Keller. The resort gear kind of gave you away here, sir.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Dave Keller from Brookside Resort in Park Rapids, Minnesota, of course, Minnesota, representing Congressman of Minnesota Resorts besides myself this morning. We as resorters work extensively with John Edmond and the Explore Minnesota Tourism Office, and we support the efforts to increase funding for this office, as the marketing of our state is a proven and direct return for all of us. The competition with our neighboring states, however, is stiff, and we understand in the face of the deficit that you have to work with, it's a very difficult time. We support the governor's proposal for a 1% tax on car rentals dedicated to tourism marketing. It was recommended by the state's tourism, actually, as a means of diversifying the funding base for tourism marketing in Minnesota. We feel it's a modest tax within our industry to support tourism in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Keller. I don't see Brian Resch. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Brian Rushi with the Joint Religious Legislative Coalition, and the page has a handout. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We believe every budget is a moral document, and that taxes are the price we pay for civilization and even more for a good society. We think that the governor's tax plan is a good one for two reasons. It speaks to two principles that we've always held at JRLC. First, that revenues be adequate to fund basic social infrastructure, education, basic human needs, and that those revenues be raised fairly. And we think the governor's budget meets those principles. We think that the budget shortfall is largely due to an insufficiency of revenue. And you'll see in the handout that I passed out, the price of government top page that you're all familiar with. It comes out with every forecast, as you know. But inside, I want you to look, if you would please, at this graph where we've taken the price of government and charted it over a couple decades. And you can see there's surely some ups and downs. But the overall trend, I think you'd have to agree, is that there's a gentle downward slope. And the forecast says by the time we get to fiscal year 15, we will be at an almost historic low in terms of the amount of our economy that is devoted to public services. And secondly, we think the tax system should be geared to be more fair. And we think the Department of Revenue's tax incident study is kind of the guiding mileposts, if you will, or guideposts in terms of who pays taxes along the ranges of income of the Minnesota citizenry. We don't think it's unreasonable to ask people who benefit most from the way that things are arranged and the way that the economy is working to pay at least what most people pay in the total tax burdens that they are shouldering. We are very concerned about the amount of cuts that are in the governor's budget already. And the only reason that I think we're here arguing for the revenue portions of the governor's plan is because it could avert, it would certainly avert further painful cuts that I think will do irreparable harm to this state, not only to the citizens who are vulnerable and rely on public service, but I also think it will do harm in terms of positioning the state, giving it a competitive advantage and making it possible for us to be the best workforce in the nation, the best place to do business, and to have a breakaway strategy from the rest of the states. This has been a hallmark of Minnesota. I hate to see us not play the strong suit that we have, which is our investment in people and the quality of our workforce. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Rushi. Did I pronounce that better the second time?
Yeah,
Rushi, is that right?
Okay. Yep.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. And Ms. Madden, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nan Madden. I'm director of the Minnesota Budget Project. The Minnesota Budget Project is an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and we provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues. We see the public sector as a partner with Minnesota residents, with the nonprofit sector, and the business community in creating a state with a high quality of life and in which all people have the opportunity to succeed. We believe that our state and our economy benefit from public investments, including in infrastructure, in the human capital of our residents, and the way we care for each other and ensure that all people can live in dignity. There's no question that the national economic recession has hit our state hard and has resulted in a large budget deficit. Your challenge is not only to balance the budget, but to do so in a way that meets the needs of Minnesotans struggling today and makes investments in the state's future. We're pleased that the governor has taken a balanced approach that uses both revenue increases and spending cuts to balance the budget. When we look at how our deficits have been addressed in the past, we see it isn't a matter of whether we raise revenues, but how we raise revenues. Past budget solutions have not raised state-level taxes, but we have seen dramatic increases tuition in our public colleges and universities, pressure on property taxes, and increases in fees. We've shifted more of the responsibility for funding state and local services on to low and middle income Minnesotans. In contrast, the governor's budget asks those with higher incomes to pay a similar share of their incomes in state and local taxes as other Minnesotans do. Since the governor's budget has come out, many questions have been raised about what the impact would be on high-income individuals, and what can we learn from other states who have raised taxes on their highest-income households. People have mentioned the fact that in Maryland and Oregon, after they raised taxes on their high earners, there were fewer people in those high-income brackets. However, the tax rates weren't the only things that were changing in those times. Very soon after those states raised their tax rates on high-income individuals, there was a recession that hit all states and a huge drop in the stock market. In the nation as a whole, there was an 18% reduction in the number of millionaires in 2008, for example. When we take a closer look at the data in Maryland and Oregon, we find that many of the missing millionaires, as they sometimes are called, could be found in lower tax brackets. They hadn't moved out of state. They were still there. They were paying taxes on an income that had been lowered by the economic recession. Now, that doesn't mean that no one will leave the state for tax reasons. But the experience of other states is that some people will leave, but the vast majority will stay, and the state will gain significant revenue for the public good. Today, we're still in the beginning stages of the budget debate. There's a long way to go before you and the governor reach agreement on how to address our budget shortfall. But we believe that a balanced approach that includes both raising revenues and cutting spending is a better solution than a cuts-only approach, which would hit Minnesotans hard. A cuts-only budget would mean drastic reductions in services needed by Minnesotans struggling in tough economic times. And as Mr. Rushi said, we think harms our investments in our future prosperity. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Madden. Thank you for your testimony today, folks. Mr. Ben Kiriagis from Plymouth and Mr. James White from St. Paul are next. And then behind them will be Tom Hesse, Jill Larson, and Mike Hickey. And Mr. Kiriagis?
Good morning.
Did I say it right?
Yes. The name is Ben Kiriagis, and if it sounds Greek to you, it's because it is.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. I've been in this country now for 36 years. I became a citizen by choice 30 years ago. I've been living in Plymouth for the last 24 years. And my wife and I have been owning a small business for the last 22 years. Our business is a small distributor of electronics. We employ four people. We do approximately $2 million in sales. And our income in 2010, our family income, is in excess of $150,000. I mention that only because it's relevant to the discussion. And I'm here to support the budget of Governor Dayton. And I don't have any prepared remarks, but I mostly wanted to come, and this is the first time I'm testifying, by the way, I wanted to clear a misconception. There's a lot of misconceptions out there about small business owners. And to give you an idea, I wanted to make a little analogy with you, because a lot of people, if you ask them, my guess is they would guess that the salary of the legislators is in excess of $100,000 a year. I thought that when I found out that you all work for $32,000 a year, I was surprised. And with that low of a salary, we still get plenty of people to do it. As a matter of fact, there's every election that I know is contested. So why are people willing to work for $32,000 a year? And the reason is because people want to do what's right for Minnesota. People believe in public service. And I'd like to submit to you that small business owners, and I'm here to speak on behalf of myself, we're like you. We don't just care about money. I would not mind paying more taxes as long as I know that the taxes go for better quality of life. I believe very strongly that we need very reliable infrastructure. We have not done that in the last 30 years. I believe very strongly in quality of education. I wouldn't be here if I didn't get quality of education in a state university in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I know my children got excellent education in Wayzata, and that's very important. So I'm here to tell you that small business owners that make more than $150,000 just like you, are willing to contribute more in taxes. It's only fair, and we need to do that for our children and our grandchildren. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kyriagis. Mr. Smith. No, Mr. White. I'm sorry.
Okay. Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is James White. I live in St. Paul. I do not represent any particular group, but I'm a citizen. I'm a citizen that's very concerned about what I see as this erosion of the sense of the common good. And I like to say the common good, and this is speaking a bit philosophically, but it's this idea that we are all in this game of life together and that we all share and provide for each other. A common good I kind of see is this glue that kind of holds us together. And sort of the nuts and bolts of this is things like parks, libraries, schools, roads, transit, infrastructure, judicial system, whatever. They all cost money, and we pay for that through our taxes. And when we pay our taxes, we are providing for each other. I'm very concerned that I hear continuously, taxes are bad, government's the problem, cut, cut, cut. I may propose this to you, that when you cut, when you make cuts, you're cutting jobs, jobs that are so badly needed in this state. I have one idea to increase revenue. I'm a mortgage banker, I'm a mortgage loan officer, I've been doing it for many years, and I've been collecting a tax called, a little known tax called the MRT, mortgage registration tax, and it's basically figured at $2.30 per thousand on the mortgage for all counties other than Hennepin, Ramsey, where it's $2.40 per thousand. And interestingly enough, I've never had a client say, I'm not going to pay that. Why do I have to pay that? People just go, okay. In fact, I kind of kid with the client, say, if you don't like it, you call your representative. And I do feel that this tax, one idea to raise a little revenue and very dependable revenue is to raise that, say, from 0.23 to 0.50, 50 basis points. I feel you could do this with relatively little pain. I've never had anybody say, I'm not buying that house because of the MRT. Another thing is I believe our takes are income tax. I don't like this idea, tax the rich. No, tax all of us. Everybody, we all need to pay our fair share. I might suggest the lowest rate, which is 5.30, raise that 50 basis points to 5.80. The highest earners from 7.85 to, let's say, 130 basis points to 9.15. Do this for 2 years. Come back in 2 years. Take a look at the budget. See how it looks. But I think I do support, and I'm glad personally, to pay taxes and to provide for your fellow man. But we've got to come together, and we've got to come to a compromise, and we absolutely cannot shut this state down. We're looking at a shutdown on the federal level. We cannot have a shutdown on the state level. This affects the very stability of our society. This is a very, very serious responsibility you have. Please come together and get this job done. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Next, we have Tom Hesse from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, Jill Larson from the Business Partnership, and Mike Hickey from the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Mr. Hesse, good morning.
Good morning. Members, for the record, my name is Tom Hesse. I'm with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. First of all, let me just say that we are also anticipating seeing the language of the bill. There's a few of the provisions that in the summary are not particularly clear to us, so we're hoping that we can receive that relatively shortly so we can provide more feedback on other items. I've been before the committee several times before talking about foreign operating corporations and the foreign royalty deduction. We continue to oppose eliminating those two provisions, and I won't go into any more detail on those. Let me focus a little bit on the personal income tax increases and give you some feedback from our members, which is a little bit different than what you heard from the previous two testifiers. We did solicit some feedback, and I'll just give you a couple of scenarios about what we found. First, there was a banker from Greater Minnesota that is worried that the increased personal income tax rates will take about $100,000 or more out of the capital structure of the bank. As you know, state and federal regulators are increasing the capital requirements for banks, and they're worried that when you reduce the amount of capital that the bank can retain, they'll be able to lend less, and that may have certainly an impact on their future growth and future ability to employ Minnesotans. There was a startup company that right now only has two employees in the state and contracts with eight independent sales representatives that is on the verge of landing a large national account. This individual said if they land this account, they'll be able to employ around 100 people and will likely do that someplace else other than Minnesota if this provision, this tax bill were to be enacted. There are others, stories similar to that that indicate that there will certainly be some economic impact of the personal income tax provisions in this legislation. Just two other provisions I want to touch on briefly. The foreign partnership income provision, in my view, I think it's attempting to overturn a recent Minnesota Supreme Court case in which the department tried to characterize a partnership that had, had its principal office and articles of formation in France as a U.S. corporation. And I think the court probably got that right and said that the state should not be able to tax that entity. So we urge you to reject that. And also we have some concern with the economic substance language. Again, we're anxious to see the language so we can provide more specific comments. But I'll leave it at that and be happy to answer questions later. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hesse. Ms. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. The Business Partnership also opposes the income tax increase proposals in the governor's budget. The new fourth bracket would give us the second highest rate in the country. The new temporary surcharge would make us the highest tax rate. Our members' concern with this proposal is couple of things. We're concerned that it really wouldn't be temporary. Other states that have imposed temporary surtaxes have continued those taxes because they have not brought in the revenue that was anticipated, and so they have had to continue them. What our members tell us is that we are already the fifth highest income tax state in the nation, and it's already difficult to recruit top talent to come here. If these proposals were to pass, it would make it more difficult to recruit that top talent. If they are able to bring those people here, they oftentimes need to pay more to compensate for the higher taxes. That puts those businesses in a less competitive position. As you know, capital and talent are more mobile than they've ever been, and the concern is that those jobs will not come here. There's been a lot of discussion about whether or not people will leave the state if this passes. I think should be also a concern about whether or not people will come here, and we need to grow the tax base, and there's concern that this will go in the opposite direction. Been a lot of discussion about the tax incident study and how this proposal evens out the so-called disparity between the high-income people and the low-income people. You look at the tax incident study, one of the biggest reasons why there is that so-called disparity is because of business taxes. Business taxes are very regressive, and that is one of the major reasons why you see the difference in the overall effective tax rates. And that is why we also oppose some of the corporate tax increases in the governor's budget, oppose the repeal of the foreign royalty deduction, repeal of the foreign operating corporation provisions. The royalty deduction incentivizes high-tech companies to keep high-tech, high-paying jobs here in Minnesota. That is a sector that we need to keep and grow here in Minnesota, and so we would encourage you to oppose those proposals. Also, we need to see the language on the economic substance proposal before we can give you our comments on the impact of that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Good morning, Mr. Hickey.
Madam Chair, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. We're the state's largest small business group and the group that represents the most entities with about 13,000 businesses in Minnesota and 300,000 nationwide. No surprise, we've been in here many times on some of these issues. We're strongly opposed to aspects of this tax plan. Frankly, I was a little shocked when I heard about the surtax and the new rate of 13.95%. That is so out of the mainstream and would make Minnesota so unappealing to people. We have a lot of sub-S filers. We have some of our more successful members be affected by this. Going down to the lower permanent rate change to 10.95%, more of our members affected. And these are the people we're looking to grow the economy, expand their jobs, try to employ people, and lead us out of this recession. And all this really smacks in the face of people who are trying to accomplish things in this state and hopefully turn our economy around. I was a little surprised by the 10.95% the governor campaigned on that, and that's no surprise. But at $85,000, that does surprise me. Is that wealthy in anybody's mind? Should $85,000 single filer be paying, under this plan, the third highest income tax in the nation? We'd have the third and the first. And I think what's notable about this is we've seen past proposals in this committee, but none of them went this far. And I think the people who proposed them knew you can't go this far. You can't go into the 13% and be 3% roughly higher than anybody in the nation. And this really is a departure from even what we've seen in the past. And, you know, we've had some rigorous debate about what was proposed in the past, but this goes way beyond that. And this is really out of the mainstream, and I think it would be very, very harmful. Finally, you know, who's going to lead us out of this economy? Who's going to help our economy turn this around? Somebody who's affected by either one of these rates, the 10.95 rate, the 13.95 rate, or or somebody who just laid off a bunch of people and has almost no income. And so, you know, these proposals, I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to get revenue, but also it's not mindful of all the entrepreneurs out there who are now paying their taxes on the sub-S or LLC and are impacted by this.
Thank you, Mr. Hickey. Next, we have Mr. Paul Enger from the Minnesota Realtors, Ward Ines from the Interactive Travel Association, and Dane Smith from Growth and Justice. Mr. Enger, good morning and welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Paul Egger, Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Association of Realtors. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today and to share some thoughts that our members have about the governor's budget recommendations. I do want to start with a couple of items that we want to share our appreciation to the governor for preserving in his budget. One is the property tax refund program, which is, as the members of this committee well know, that is a means-tested, income-based form of property tax relief. Our association has a longstanding position of support for that program, and we're glad to see that it's preserved in the governor's budget. We would also like to thank the governor for preserving the mortgage interest deduction in his budget and also for not extending the sales tax to services such as real estate services. So on those items, we certainly want to thank the governor for preserving and, excuse me, not eliminating or utilizing the sales tax on services. There is one item that we do have concerns about in the governor's budget, and it was mentioned by Ms. Nauman earlier, and it is the state residential property tax provision. Our members do oppose that particular provision in the governor's budget for a few reasons. The primary reason, Madam Chair, is that the property tax is primarily a local revenue generator for supporting local services, and we certainly do not want to see the property tax used as a means of providing state general fund resources. We want to maintain that as a revenue source for local government operations. We also have a longstanding position at the association of not singling out one particular class of property or one particular transaction for a statewide problem. And as a couple of examples I would cite is there have been various discussions over the years at the legislature to utilize a point-of-sale approach to addressing septic systems. And our association has always opposed an approach like that because it singles out one particular class of Minnesotans, those in a homeowning or a buying a home or selling a home, to start making progress on an issue that's really of statewide significance. And so along those lines, we just have a concern that we're singling out one particular class of properties to contribute to a problem that is a Minnesota statewide problem. With that, Madam Chair, I know you're pressed for time, so I will conclude my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony this morning. Mr. Ines, Commissioner, welcome back to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines, and I'm here on behalf of the Interactive Travel Services Association. This is an association that represents Expedia, Travelocity, Orbitz, among others. And we're here to voice our opposition to the governor's proposal to increase the lodging tax. It's difficult to talk too authoritatively about the proposal until we actually see the language. But based on the budgetary narrative, it appears that he is expanding the sales tax on lodging. And I want to make it clear that the narrative seems to indicate this is merely a clarification of current law. And I can speak authoritatively that the Department of Revenue has never taken the position that is laid out in the governor's proposal. We've never audited that position. We've never assessed a taxpayer based on this position, and we've never litigated with a taxpayer based on this position. So I think it's a mischaracterization to say that this is merely a clarification of current law. It is, in fact, an expansion of the existing lodging tax.
Thank you, Mr. Innes. Mr. Smith, good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Dane Smith, president of Growth and Justice. We're a nonpartisan research organization focused on economics and tax and budget issues, and our fundamental mission is to expand prosperity in Minnesota so that more of us are successful. We think private gain and business growth are a good thing, and our communities, and we think our community's desire for public good, smart public investment, and economic justice is just as good a thing. And we're convinced that both profits and taxes in the right balance are good and essential for Minnesota. We do support Governor Dayton's budget and tax proposal, and especially so if the only alternative is an all cuts or yet another no new revenue response. We also could support a variety of other options, and we are sure others will emerge that provide new revenue and that make the tax system overall less regressive. We also encourage you to consider a comprehensive long-term redesign of our tax system that is more revenue positive, that provides long-term structural soundness, and is more attuned to a changing economy. To cut to the chase, we desperately need both short-term and long-term to restore revenue to our depleted budget base. Minnesota's officially established price of state and local government is projected to fall to 15% of personal income by 2015. That's down from a high of almost 18% of personal income in 1994, or a difference of about $6.6 billion a year if the price we paid then had been kept at the same percentage. We are not necessarily recommending a return to that high point price, but the lower price is not producing a stronger economy, and we need to keep in perspective that over generations we have found that right-sized government works well for us. A truly impressive, wide-ranging variety of Minnesotans are saying that at long last we desperately need a more balanced budget approach. And in recent years, four out of five former governors representing all major parties have agreed on the need for more revenue and more balance. And while Governor Dayton's initial proposal looks a little heavy on the tax side and the income tax in particular, it does not look that way at all in historical context. For a decade now, since we enacted some of the largest income tax cuts in our history, we have balanced shortfall after shortfall, almost entirely with shifts, spending of reserves, deep, deep cuts in the crucial public investments that are good for business in the long run. And these cuts include business inputs such as roads and sewers, schools and universities, technology and research, first-rate hospitals, healthcare, and economic security, too. Business does better when the middle class has more economic security. As Governor Dayton frequently says these days, these are hard choices. Both have negative consequences. Both income tax increases and reductions in public investment can affect jobs negatively. But continuing this policy of cuts in public investment actually is the more damaging option within our borders because these cuts have a greater immediate impact on households already spending all they earn, while people with plenty of income typically spend less than they earn and they return less to the Minnesota economy in the short run. Many top income people actually invest outside our borders and even outside the United States. Last year, our senior policy fellow, Marcia Blumenthal, professor emerita at the University of St. Thomas, and Charlie Quimby, a former owner of a public relations firm, produced a policy brief for us that arrived at just this conclusion, and that from a careful review of economic literature comparing likely job loss of equal amounts of income tax increases and budget cuts, that the job loss from the cuts would be greater. A similar verdict on this trade-off nationally for the states, in reference to states, has been rendered by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz, by economists such as Peter Orszag, and our own state economist, Tom Stinson, in this room 2 years ago, offered a similar analysis. In testimony, he said that analyzing the job loss from equal amounts of unallotment and a billion-dollar income tax increase vetoed by the governor, then-Governor Pawlenty, economist Stinson estimated that the cuts would cost 3,300 to 4,700 jobs, while the income tax increase would cost about 1,000 jobs. So the bottom line is, and this is a point often voiced by mainstream economists and business leaders, and even conservatives such as David Brooks, is that if we don't maintain, rebuild, and reinvest in our education systems, if we don't invest more resources in improving our early childhood preparation and higher education attainment, and if we don't continue to invest in our physical infrastructure, we will continue to lose our luster as one of the most profitable and one of the fairest nations in the nation, and that goes for Minnesota.
Mr. Smith.
And our goal is to increase by half, by the way, the percentage of young adults who have completed some sort of post-high school, college, or vocational training. That's what we need to focus on, but we do need revenue to raise that. We need to raise revenue to do that. You have a tough job, and as you try to find the budget balance, we'd be happy to help you with ideological bridge building and consensus-seeking advice, and happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Thank you all for your testimony. Ms. Nancy Braymeyer, from the president or financial planner president of the Metro IBA. Are you here, Ms. Braymeyer? If not, are there other members here in the room of the public that would like to testify in support or in opposition of the state taxes and local aids and credits portion of Governor Dayton's budget? If not, we would like to, Senator Pogemiller, I was when we started, Mr. Carlson from the League of Minnesota Cities, and Mr. Carlson from the Metro Intercounty Association had additional comments or were presented with questions, and we're hoping we can take the rest of your testimony on those issues. And then Senator Pogemiller, did you have questions for other folks as well? Do you want to let us know who you would like to talk
Business Partnership and Chamber of Commerce.
So if you would be preparing to be next up, Ms. Larson and Mr. Hesse. Mr. Carlson, I think it would be worthwhile to go back through your handout. And I know you got as far as I had a numbered version, but you got as far as the child support incentive grants.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just quickly, again, child support incentive grants are monies that the state gives to the counties to assist them in their cost of child support collections were mandated by the federal government to do that for individuals on public assistance, and we are also required to do that for individuals not on public assistance when they request our help in collecting those monies. I did skip over CD treatment. CD treatment is a direct shift of state costs to the counties. Again, we have no choice but to pay these monies. Offender supervision is the cost that the counties either pay two-thirds of or provide directly to supervise the 130,000 of the approximately 140,000 criminals under sanctions for past crimes of which they've been convicted. We have to supervise these individuals or incarcerate them, depending on the terms of their sentences. And our probation includes making sure they're not using drugs or alcohol, making sure they're where they're supposed to be at the time they were supposed to be, and where they're not supposed to be. All of which goes towards public safety. Madam Chair, that really completes my testimony. I'd certainly be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Carlson, I appreciate your going through that. And so I'm just trying to understand, you are testifying against the cuts that the governor made.
Madam Chair, I'm not testifying against the cuts. I just want the members to be aware of the breadth of the governor's changes on counties. As I said, we're the one level of local government that are actually cut under this budget. I think there's a misimpression because aids and credits that all local governments escaped unscathed. That's not true in the case of counties, and we just ask you take that into consideration in your further deliberations on the matters before this committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson. And Mr. Gary Carlson, I know Senator Rust posed a big topic for you. Are you prepared to, with some response?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Rust, it's good that Keith is here as well, because I think these issues really dovetail into cities and counties. The question was really whether we could shape some sort of a compromise where we might grant a sales tax exemption for city, I presume city and county purchases, given the way the sales tax law is structured, repeal the market value homestead credit, and then do some level of LGA cuts, and would that be acceptable? Let me just say at the outset that all three of those programs have benefits that fall differently upon units of government, and where LGA goes is not necessarily where the sales tax exemption benefits would necessarily fall. And just to give you an example, some of our very small communities that are very LGA reliant might not make a lot of purchases per year that would really qualify or provide them a sales tax benefit. So I guess I would reserve the right to really more fully analyze the interactions of those programs. Let me just tell the committee that the sales tax repeal, I think the last fiscal note that was done on that indicated that cities and counties would save roughly $150 million per year in terms of sales tax paid on taxable purchases. So that's a very big ticket item for you know, each year for cities and counties. I think townships would have some of those taxes exempted as well.
Madam Chair, it's a little
Senator
bit
Rest.
Less. It's a little bit less than that.
Okay.
In the most recent, like yesterday.
Oh. I haven't seen
about
the most recent
fiscal note. About $130 million.
I haven't seen the most recent fiscal note. And then just very briefly on the market value homestead credit, you know, we would like to find a way to reform that system because, in fact, I think as Mr. Sulem indicated, as we've indicated in past testimony, what happens is that there's an amount of money that's supposed to go to cities to cover a portion of their property tax levy that they're telling their residents they're going to collect and that it is not reimbursed. The totality of the market value homestead credit appropriation is, if you take the ag and the non-ag portions, about $568 million for this upcoming biennium. Only about $50 million per year, or about $100 million of that biennium, if I'm not mistaken, is really of direct benefit to cities. That's the residual that is being paid after the cuts that were extended last biennium, or last session, I should say. So this is a big ticket item. It does affect cities, counties, school districts, townships, and special taxing entities. It's not just a city program. Let me be clear about that. So we'd have to look at how that would fall. So I would like to think more about this, but I think just to let the committee know that the benefits of that trade-off might fall very differently than the distribution of LGA.
Madam Chair, can I just comment on that?
Mr. Keith Carlson.
Specifically on the market value-based credits, I want to emphasize again that the lion's share of local governments, be it counties, cities, or school districts, do not budget this reimbursement. They budget the levy that we certify to the county auditor to collect, and then the lion's share of it is what we receive each May and October and November from our taxpayers, and then the remainder, what supposedly is the credit on the statement, is what we receive in reimbursement from the state for the credit that the homeowner or farmer is supposed to receive. And in this will be the fifth year in a row that what appears on the statement is much larger than what we actually receive in reimbursement. So I guess I would ask the committee and the legislature at large, make a decision as to what you think can afford in that area. If that happens to be zero, so be it. But don't continue to put us in a situation where what appears on the statement has state payments to reduce your property taxes and is in reality not a state payment and is leaving each local government in the state short by the amount of the underpayment of that reimbursement.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Other questions for these folks? Senator Chamberlain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson, the League of Cities, Carlson. It's true, correct, that many cities don't get LGA, correct?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Chamberlain, I believe the last count was roughly 100 or 120 cities. About 1 in 8 cities no longer receives LGA, correct?
Madam Chair, follow up.
Senator Chamberlain.
We spent quite some time getting into this mess, and we've unfortunately got cities used to collecting, getting these dollars, and it's a tough spot to be in, admittedly. For those cities that do not collect the LGA, would you say they do not have police or fire service or adequate police or fire service? I've been hearing this argument for quite some time. I live in a city that has good police and fire service that gets no LGA.
Mr. Gary Carlson.
I haven't heard that direct argument that if you don't get LGA, you don't have adequate police and fire services. I know that the reductions in LGA that have been done over the last, especially the last 3 years, have challenged some cities because those cuts were almost retroactive to the budget being in place. And once we set our property tax levy in December, we can't adjust those budgets for major revenues until we set that levy again in the subsequent December. So if it's a argument about the effect of the recent cuts, there may be situations where cities have had to make decisions about police and fire staffing because of the retroactive nature. In terms of the long-term effect of cities just not receiving LGA, I guess I still haven't heard any direct comments about cities just because they don't get LGA having an absolutely inadequate level of police and fire. But it's probably one of those value judgments about how much you can afford without any of that state assistance.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't remember who said this statement earlier because it was a while ago, but I think it was one of you gentlemen. You indicated that many police and firemen have been laid off throughout, you know, these last number of years. Do you have kind of a spreadsheet for us that shows what cities, how many police, how many firemen were laid off? Do you have any information like that for us?
Mr. Rice.
Madam Chairman, Brian Rice, of Minnesota Professional Firefighters and Minneapolis Police Federation. I can answer this question. Since 2002, the Minneapolis Fire Department has lost 65 firefighters from 2002 till now. I know that there have been fewer positions in the Minneapolis Police Department, and I can try to provide additional information to you. But my earlier testimony was that, and this is just a general indication, the PRA Police and Fire Fund, for the first time ever between July 1 of 2009 and July 1 of 2010, actually had a reduction of about 100 participant members. And I testify that I believe that's a leading indicator that cities and throughout the state are now in the mode of shrinking their police and fire departments. But I'll try to get you, the committee, some additional information on that.
Thank you.
Mr. Rice, I had a question about this, too, so I'm glad you're at the table. The police and police departments and fire departments have been given federal grants for positions, and those grants require the local governments to guarantee that those salaries will continue, that those positions will continue, even without the federal funding. So wouldn't that be a factor in some of the reductions to your forces and reductions to the budgets that you have available?
Yes, you're correct, Madam Chair. It's called the Clinton COPS program in the 90s, and now for fire departments it's called the SAFER grants. And I know St. Paul has entered into one, city of Brainerd has. There are several other departments of various sizes that have gotten federal grants, and that part of the condition of the grant is that they agree to fund their positions beyond the term of the grants. There's about a two-year federal match for the first 2 years, and then there has to be a commitment to back those up again longer term. So and again, to the committee, I said this before, we're 47th in fire protection, we're about 22nd in public safety, but that's largely that was one of the few areas in the Plenty administration where our relative ranking on these expenditures increased was the public safety area. Fire safety stayed about the same. So from the police and fire perspective, we would urge the committee to look at that as you consider these cuts, because they will have an effect. And we also know how dire the circumstances. I mean, there's no doubt the challenge in front of this committee is horrendous.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Rice, just one quick follow-up, Senator Howe. The stimulus grants from the Obama administration also had some of those same provisions. They were granting for positions that cities and counties were keeping related to law enforcement, and required an agreement on the part of those local cities and counties that they would maintain funding for those positions even when the grant funding was completed. And I think we should be really mindful of that too, that it's not just LGA that's impacting your budgets, it's also the federal grants.
You are correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, you know, in Red Wing, we added three firefighters with the SAFER grant program. And the first year, they covered the salaries. The second year, most of the salaries. And then it shifted to the local community to pay it. But, you know, we were able to justify that just in the cost of overtime, the reduced overtime and callbacks. So it made fiscal sense to do that. But I think when we talk about LGA, you know, the program needs to be redefined and probably even renamed because LGA just goes to a community's general fund. That's what it does not translate 100% into fire, police, or infrastructure. It goes to the general fund and it's used however it needs to be used. And I think there is, we should fund essential services. So we should probably do away with LGA and come up with ESA, Essential Services Aid. And it should be directed towards police, fire, public infrastructure projects. I think that would be a better term. LGA wasn't designed for that. I know that, but I think it should have been designed for that. I think there should be a basic level of essential services in our communities. That's just my comment on it.
Thank you, Senator Howe. Mr. Keith Carlson.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe's comments reminded me that he had raised an issue earlier that I'd like to comment on, and that's the payment that he said the state made to the spouses and children of officers killed in the line of duties. Mr. Rice correctly identified that the state payment is made out of the general fund. The governor is proposing changing where that comes out of to the fire safety account. But I need to remind the committee that although the state created the obligation, they have not fully funded it for a number of years. The current claims on that account is about $2.5 million a year. The state appropriation is 1.36, yep. 1.37. The cities and counties are making up the rest.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, the reason I brought that up is we had I'm on the Transportation Committee, and we had that budget overview, and there is going to be a change to that. So that's I didn't know if Mr. Rice knew that or not, but you're correct on the numbers there.
Thank you, gentlemen. If we could have Ms. Larson and Mr. Hesse join us.
Yes, I wanted to just,
Senator
Commissioner
Ines
has looked at this chart for me, former Commissioner Ines. I just wanted to ask him a quick question before I ask the question.
Well, why don't you guys just come to the table because we're going to try and finish up here.
Madam Chair, I passed out this chart, and it's constant dollars per capita. And I believe I just wanted to verify that this is along the lines of what we talked about in the last several years of because of the downturn in the economy, there basically is a collapse in revenue. And this looks about right, doesn't it, Commissioner, in terms of class? I'm not suggesting you support what Governor Dayton is recommending. I'm just saying that factually there was a collapse in revenue.
Madam Chair, Senator Pogemiller, I concur with that.
Okay.
I think this chart looks very similar to other charts I've seen there. In constant terms, the per capita dollars are...
Right. Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. And members, the only thing... Commissioner, thank you. The only
Senator
thing I wanted
Pogemiller.
To point out here, then, the part that Governor Dayton's office would like to make is that the blue line is all they're suggesting here. They're suggesting we have had a collapse in revenue in a balanced solution. We should try to get back some of that revenue. Whether you agree with the source of his suggestion or not, he's suggesting that you need to get some revenue, otherwise you can't maintain... even the current level of spending. So,
Senator Pogemiller, you're suggesting that this came directly from the governor's office?
This was worked on by someone in the governor's office and myself, yes.
Senator Pogemiller, who from the governor's office could speak to the preparation of this and the fact that it's the governor's position? Is there someone we could have before the committee to talk about how they prepared this information
and
the sources?
Sure, I can find out. Sure, absolutely. I can figure out who helped me with that.
I can recall it later.
Okay. I would appreciate that information, Senator Pogemiller, because we'd like to understand what's
but
being presented here.
But I take credit for the document. I believe it's accurate, and that's why
Your
I asked Commissioner to come up. I
well,
believe it's accurate.
And Senator Rust has a point that we might like to know what the sources are for this information.
Well, right
other
here
than
it says
it
LJP,
says
Lawrence Joseph Pogemiller.
Joseph
is good.
Joseph.
So I take full responsibility for the chart. I believe it's accurate.
Well, and Senator Pogemiller, it looks like you're working on talking points for your caucus here. I, I think we'd
Madam
like
Chair,
to know more.
Madam Chair, please give me more credit than that.
I appreciate
I'm
your work on
I'm working on talking
this.
Points for things that I believe to be accurate. I no longer lead my caucus, Senator, if you haven't noticed.
Senator Pogamiller.
So what you're going to see
I don't
from
mean to be disrespectful.
Well, I thought that was disrespectful, Madam Chair.
Senator Pogamiller, we'd like to have a further discussion of this if this is the governor's position. We would just like to talk about this in that light.
That would be fine.
Thank
I'm
you.
I'm sure they would love to talk
and,
to you about it.
And Senator Pogamiller, I have been working on handouts too. There are three in the packet for members. They are not my work. They are all from the Wall Street Journal. One is an article about why investors can't get more cash out of U.S. companies relating to the FOC provisions and foreign royalty deductions and why we need to continue them. Another one is about the Amazon and Internet sales discussion going on in other states as well as here in Minnesota. And the third one is an opinion by Martin Feldstein, want to boost the economy, lower corporate tax rates. So those provisions are, or those handouts are in your packets, members. Senator Pogamiller.
Madam Chair, I read all three of your articles. I thought they were excellent. And I'm going to pass on later from the Star and Tribune today, which I just found fascinating for today's topic. But that's just for your own perusal.
Thank you, Senator Pogamiller. Did you have questions
I do.
For either
I
Ms. Larson
do.
Or Mr. Hessing? We just are just about out of time here, Senator. So
I can wait till next meeting. Because I do have several questions. And
they are here now, okay. So hopefully you can ask your most important questions.
Could I be assured that they'll be back before the committee?
Senator Pogamiller, I'd be surprised
great.
If they aren't willing to be back before the committee to talk
Thank
about
you.
These issues.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, as long as the point came up, I want to assure members of the committee that since I no longer do lead my caucus, you can be assured that whatever I say in public comments is what I believe. So.
Senator Pogamiller.
I absolutely understand, having heard testimony from the organizations over the years, I absolutely understand that you do not support, believe it's wrong for the state, believe it kills jobs, et cetera, Governor Dayton's proposal on the income tax. I absolutely understand that. Do you believe there is any revenue that is necessary for the state at this point in time, additional revenue, or do you believe there should be an all-cuts budget presented to structurally balance the budget? Organizationally, what do your organizations believe? And the follow-up question will be, obvious, if you do believe it should be all cuts.
Mr. Hesse.
Senator Pogamiller, the position that the chamber has taken is we should balance the budget within the existing resources. I don't know.
And which number would that be from
Senator
your perspective,
Pogamiller.
The $32 million, the $30
million? The,
Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair and Senator Pogamiller, currently the forecasted revenue is about $32 billion.
Okay,
I'm guessing that number will change next week when the February forecast comes out. So, you know, it will.
So whatever
flux.
That number is, the
Senator
32,
Pogamiller.
30. Okay, great. Within that number, okay.
And Madam Chair and Senator Pogamiller, the and I guess it all depends on how you define revenue. If extending the shift is considered revenue, then you know I think. We feel that that should be part of the equation to help balance the state's budget. Beyond that, I think our members are interested in certainly looking at the other areas of state spending, the cost drivers of the state, specifically the Health and Human Services budget. If you look at the Budget Trends Commission report, that really kind of acknowledges that we're in a long-term problem on the spending side, that if we don't get control of state health care costs, we could increase taxes this biennium to balance the budget. We might have to increase taxes the next biennium and the next biennium and the biennium after that if we don't control the rate of growth of the Health and Human Service budget and in other areas of the budget. So I think we're trying to find strategies to address some of those areas. As well as other areas of the state budget.
So,
thank you, Mr. Hesse.
So,
Senator Pogamiller, just remember, we're out of time here. So last question
for
today, and they will come back.
Okay.
Senator
Pogamiller. So you're saying that you think that we should hit the $32 billion mark in terms of spending?
Mr. Hesse.
Madam Chair and Senator Pogamiller, and again, I know some people, when they say all cuts budget don't include the shift, the K-12 education shift. So I'm trying to
okay, I don't
know what how you're
Madam Chair,
define that.
I don't think the shift affects the $32 billion figure. It's not a trick question. I'm just trying to figure out. So you think we should get to the $32
billion? Mr.
Hesse. That is, Madam Chair and Senator Pogamiller, that is what our board has directed us to try to find a way to get to.
Thank you.
Ms. Larson, would you like to respond?
Madam Chair, Senator Pogamiller, just in the interest of time, agree with Mr. Hesse's comments. The goal is to try to take a look at some spending reform. I think the Budget Trends Commission report says it all. If we just do short-term tax increases, such as in the governor's budget proposal, we're going to be back in the soup in a couple of years. And so our members want us to take a look at some spending reform.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Senator Pogamiller.
I don't think there's any disagreement on that. What I'm trying to ascertain is you think we should hit the $32 billion level?
Madam Chair,
Ms.
Senator
Larson.
Pogamiller, again, I think, our members would say, let's take a look at the existing revenues that are coming in and try to build a budget from those. And if that includes the shift, I think our members would be fine with the shift. If the budget forecast looks better next week.
Do you think we should hit the $32 billion
level? Senator Pogamiller.
That's what the estimate is for revenue under the current
Senator
tax system.
Senator Pogamiller, as of today,
Ms. Larson.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, just one quick comment. People's positions modify the further they get in and the further they learn about things. And, I would say a year ago you would have had everybody in the educational system saying, you're going to pay us back that money. You're going to pay us back that shift money. And I think now they're saying, well, they know if the money gets paid back and if we don't do the shift that there's going to be cuts to the educational system, And I think that's why people have modified their position on that and said, I think we're okay with the shift now because we don't want to take an additional cut. So, the further you get into digging into the details, more of these things surface. I just heard the shift talked about maybe about five or six times in this conversation, and I think people need to understand what we're talking about.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michelle was first, and Senator Michelle, you're going to be given the final word here. Sorry, Senator Pogamiller. You said you would take up the rest of your comments on another day. Did you want to speak to the point that Senator Howe just made?
Yes.
Senator Pogamiller and Michelle.
The shift has nothing to do with the $32 billion level. The shift is a side issue. The $32 billion spending level is what you just spoke to. And I passed out a chart last meeting. I do genuinely think you ought to look at that and see if you really think your organization support the $32 billion level. I don't see how that's possible.
To that
Senator
point.
Senator Howe, and then Senator Michelle, and then we will adjourn.
Madam Chair, the shift does have something to do with the spending because it has something to do with the revenue side. So it has something to do with where we get our money from. So when you're talking about where do you account for everything that you're going to spend from, that's where we look at these numbers. When you say spending is only going up by 7.5%, that's because you've got the $2.3 billion federal stimulus money and you got a $1.8 billion shift in there. That does account. And now we're talking about state spending going up 22.5% because you're not accounting for the shift and you're not accounting for the stimulus money. That's a one-time deal.
Senator Michelle.
Madam Chair, so I think the question that I would ask, and I don't expect it to be answered now, and I appreciate you giving me a little time at the end of the scrum here. But the question I would ask,
Senator, I think that trivializes. This is not a scrum.
Senator Pogamiller, you've not been recognized.
Senator
Michelle.
We are going to have a lot of serious discussions, but we won't take ourselves too seriously.
Okay. Senator, these are not games or scrums.
Members, we're going to hear from Senator Michelle.
So my question, where I think at least the two folks at this table and many of the witnesses have been before us already is, Help this committee, or at least help this member, put the Dayton budget proposal, the Dayton tax proposals, into perspective. And when I say that, I'm really curious, and I want to do a lot of homework on what other states and even what other countries are doing with their budgets and with their tax plans. As I understand it, the governor is now off at the National Governors Association meeting, which I think is great. He needs to rub elbows with 49 other governors who all face a very similar circumstance. I've been trying to keep track. There are three other governors, like Governor Dayton, who are talking about tax increases. So, okay, let's double that. There's seven. I'm trying to be respectful to the governor. There's seven other governors who are talking about tax increases to balance a budget. That means there's 43 governors around the country that are holding the line or even reducing taxes. I think that needs to be a big part of the discussion at this table, in other committees, and on the Senate floor. How are we setting up Minnesota to win this competition versus other states, to win this competition versus other countries? Let's learn from what other states are doing. Let's learn from what other governors are doing. So if either of your organizations can add to that discussion at a level of specificity, that would be greatly, greatly helpful and constructive.
Madam Chair?
Senator Michelle had the final word here. Senator Pogemiller, can you take up your comments next week?
I'm just asking. I genuinely meant I Senator, hope you'll look at Senator the $32 billion level and see if that's possible.
Thank you, Senator Pogemiller. Next week, members, we are going to take up TIF-related bills on Tuesday, sales tax-type bills on Wednesday, and we're going to have a hearing on dynamic scoring on Thursday. I'm looking forward to that. Members, thank you for your work today. We are adjourned.